John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, and thank you so much for listening. Well, today, Washington State opens up a new market for their economy. Legalized recreational marijuana goes on sale, and we're going to find out how that state is preparing. They're not the first to the party, but they have their own concerns. Plus, the fate of thousands of Afghan interpreters who worked alongside American soldiers and are now viewed as traitors by the Taliban. That's all part of a new investigation over at Vice. But we begin on the U.S. border and south of it today. Unaccompanied migrant children are pouring into the United States at a rate of more than 1,000 per week. It's created what has become a humanitarian crisis and a political conundrum here. But as Washington struggles for a solution, we want to explore a little bit about the conditions driving these kids to flee their home countries. Long before taking on a dangerous and sometimes horrific journey, a lot of these kids are born into neighborhoods and lives that offer little hope of progress and the immediate threat of violence. Now, that violence has surged in recent years in many Central American countries, plagued by poverty and political instability. Honduras, in fact, has the most murders per capita of any country in the world, with an average of 19 people killed per day in 2013.
Honduras is in a really bad place right now. El Salvador, Guatemala, the push factor is what is driving this recent influx.
That's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. He talks about the push factor, and there is also a pull factor in U.S. immigration policy. In just a minute, we'll hear from Republican Congresswoman Candace Miller from Michigan, who's calling for an end to U.S. aid in that region. But first, I want to turn to Tracy Wilkinson. She's Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, you just returned from Guatemala last week, is that right?
That's correct.
And what did you find?
Well, we found a lot of children who had been trying to get to the United States. We ran into some who had been caught in Mexico and deported back to their homes in Guatemala. These are kids, you know, teenagers who just gave up on living in Guatemala, where they have very little opportunity, few jobs. One girl we spoke to, her family could no longer afford to pay for schooling. And so they see the only chance they have for a future is to go to the United States.
So that seems to be an economic draw of the United States for young people who don't have a lot of opportunity at home. What about the threat of gang violence? Another thing that we're reading about, most of the stories about Guatemala and Honduras paint a picture of gang violence that's so bad that teenagers flee because otherwise they'll be forced to join a gang.
That's very true. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have terrible gang problems that have existed for a while. This goes back to the mid-90s, but is getting worse in many parts. There are entire neighborhoods in Honduras and in El Salvador that are controlled by gangs. And so teenagers have the choice of joining a gang and likely getting eventually killed, or not joining a gang and also getting killed. So there's very little choice. Honduras has one of the highest murder rates in the world. And so, and in Guatemala, too, it's just a sense of lawlessness. People describe people getting killed every day. You know, the other day, this person was killed, and then with that, you know, this person was killed at the market, and this person was killed there. And so it is a constant threat of just inescapable violence.
And it's a very scary situation for them, Tracy Wilkinson. And I'm curious about sort of the calculus that you hear from teenagers fleeing, let's say, Guatemala. A violence at home is so dangerous so that they fear for their lives. There's no economic opportunity. At the same time, the journey to an attractive place like the United States is dangerous. It's expensive, potentially deadly. What's kind of the calculus that goes on in the heads of some of the kids maybe that you talk to?
Right. Well, that's what I kept asking. You know, why now? We went through a period the last couple of years where it was very dangerous for Central American migrants to cross Mexico. The drug cartels in Mexico were kidnapping, killing, raping, extorting migrants that tried to pass through. And in fact, we saw a decline a couple of years ago in Central Americans trying to cross because it was so dangerous. That has shifted now as Central Americans hear that it's perhaps easier now to cross into the United States, especially children, especially single parents with children. They have made the calculation that, well, it's worth taking the risk. I think the cartels are in on this as well, I think. I mean, we're still reporting some of this out, but I think they must be getting a cut of the from the coyotes, the guides who take these people through and who get paid a lot of money to do so, because we aren't hearing of mass slayings of kids.
One of the criticisms here at home is that U.S. policy allegedly sends the message to these young people that if they manage to cross over the border, it will be much easier for them to stay. Now, the law says that young people who arrived before 2007 won't be sent back in many of the conditions that we're talking about here, and that a lot of immigrant kids are misinformed, but they come anyway. What's the impression that people have of the law, and is that really a draw for them to come here?
Well, I think it is a draw. I mean, there are two. There's the pushing factor, which is the violence and the poverty, but there is also the draw, this belief, justified or not, that it's easier to cross and you would be allowed to stay. I heard from many people who said relatives had called them from the U.S. and said, now is the time, come. And even some of the aid workers that work in Guatemala and Honduras are telling people that now is the time. So that is certainly a belief that has been created, and I'm not sure can be very easily dispelled.
There is a big push for child immigrants pushed to travel a dangerous road to the United States, and also a poll. Tracy Wilkinson from the Los Angeles Times says we need to deal with the push, maybe most urgently. Tracy Wilkinson, thank you.
Thank you.
We turn now to a conversation I had earlier today with Congresswoman Candace Miller. She's a Republican from Michigan and vice chair of the Homeland Security Committee in the House. And Miller is calling on President Obama to cut off aid to Central American countries until this crisis is addressed.
Todd, I think that we have literally, for decades, really, our nation has been sending so much foreign aid to the Centrals, particularly these countries where there is the three countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where all of these unaccompanied children are now flooding through our border. In addition to that, we've also had free trade agreements where we've really given the nations, both in Mexico and the Centrals, through NAFTA and CAFTA, enhanced access to our markets with trade. And, of course, all in the hope that they could build better economies for themselves, stronger economies, stronger civil societies. And actually, part of our rationale was there to hopefully stem the flow of illegal migration that was happening from those countries into the United States. And I would just say it has not worked. And I think because we have done that for so many years, and all of this financial assistance not working the way that we had hoped, and now we have this humanitarian crisis right on our southern border here, I think we need to actually cut off further financial assistance. I'm not talking about cutting off diplomatic ties or anything like that, but financial assistance to the countries here, because they are unwilling really to assist us in stopping these unaccompanied children from flooding our border. And I think, again, in looking at NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and CAFTA, that's the Central American Free Trade Agreement, I would ask that the president, and I have asked the president, written to him and spoken out in the Congress about having us reopen, reevaluate, and even possibly withdraw, but at a minimum, reopen and reevaluate these trade agreements.
Now, NAFTA and CAFTA and free trade agreements like them are not really popular in your part of the country there in Michigan, so that's kind of understandable. But one of the concerns about cutting off aid is that it makes a situation in these countries where economic progress is so very slow only can make it worse by cutting off U.S. aid, that whatever benefit they were getting out of it, even if there's corruption or some of it's being misused, that it can only get worse from the United States perspective if we do that.
Well, look, we're not the world's ATM machine. We are a compassionate nation. I have traveled to the Centrals, Todd. Certainly I've been to Mexico. There was very much a desire on the part of the United States to, as I say, try to assist them. The rising tide floats all boats, so they say. And that really has not happened. And many people will say that the reason you're having all of these unaccompanied children, this humanitarian crisis that is occurring at the southern border of the United States, is principally because of the economy, that they have such a very, very poor economy. Also, because of all of the violence, gang violence, and believe me, all of us recognize that it is absolutely horrific. However, it didn't just start that way. The reason that this is happening at our southern border now with these unaccompanied children coming across the border is, I believe, in my opinion, it can be laid directly at the feet of President Obama in 2011 when he made his change, without talking to the Congress, I might say, of what they call DACA. That's the deferred action against the children. And if you look at a graph, you will see that almost immediately, actually immediately after he made that determination by executive order, the line on a chart will just shoot right up through the clouds. I mean, you went from several thousand, or I think it was 6,000 unaccompanied children we had in about 2011. And, of course, today there are 60,000 going to 90,000, going to 120,000 if this is not stopped.
I'm speaking with Congresswoman Candace Miller from Michigan, a Republican. Congresswoman, before we let you go, you know, I wonder if we don't need to reevaluate maybe how we view some of these refugees. You know, somebody fleeing violence from, you know, Sudan or Somalia who comes here can often claim refugee status, and we view them very differently politically and from a legal perspective than maybe somebody who is fleeing into the country from Mexico and Guatemala. Do we need to start looking at least some of these kids as potential refugees and not just sort of immigration problems in our current immigration debate?
I think really, Todd, the first thing we need to look at as a compassionate nation, and now I am speaking now not as a member of Congress, but as a mother and a grandmother, these poor, innocent children, their parents are putting them on trains. They're paying up to $8,000 per head. They're stuffed into these cattle cars. They're on the top of these trains. It is the most horrific sight that you can imagine. Under extremely dangerous conditions, the children, it's such a dangerous environment. They are exposed to exploitation, to violence, rape, perhaps death along the route. And I think, Todd,
they sound like refugees to me when you describe these horrific conditions, Congresswoman. Those sound like refugees.
Todd, the reason they are all coming like this is because their parents think that if they can get to the United States that they will be able to just stay here like this. And I do not believe that we can just free fall, open up our complete borders without going through any kind of process. Or I believe in immigration, but it has to be legal immigration. And what is happening right now is a tsunami that is overwhelming our ability as a nation to take in these children, to process them. Our southern border right now is totally overwhelmed with what is happening here.
About $30 billion in United States aid has gone to Guatemala, Honduras, and the Centrals since 1980. Congresswoman Candace Miller is a Republican from Michigan and vice chair of the Homeland Security Committee and says most of that money should be cut off. Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, fans of the TV series Doctor Who will know that when we last left the Good Doctor, he had regenerated yet again from a young man played by actor Matt Smith to someone much older, but just as dashing, played by Peter Capaldi. Well, the season premiere is set for August 23rd, but here's the problem. Something that even a Time Lord can't put right. Turns out that scripts from the first five episodes of the new season have been leaked.
Don't look at it! Do not look!
Now don't worry, no spoilers here. We're not going to reveal any of Doctor Who's fate from the program, but our next guest is worried that he won't be able to make it until August 23rd. Joining us is Graham Burke, author of Who's 50, the 50 Doctor Who stories to watch before you die, an unofficial companion. Hi, Graham.
Hi, Todd.
Well, who's to blame? I mean, Daleks? Who would do such a thing as leaking these scripts?
Apparently, it was left on a file server in BBC America's offices in Miami. There were apparently scripts that were going to be done for Spanish translation, and they were just left on a file server, and some fan managed to get in and find them and take them for himself and share them with the internet.
So how is a fan like you and a lot of fans out there manage to look away? I mean, spoilers are the worst. The more you love a show, the less you want to see something like this.
Oh, totally. I have been sitting on my hands an awful lot the past 24 hours because it is like having the sweetest chocolate imaginable and all you want is to eat it. But you know that if you eat it, that's it. It's kind of like I use the analogy of it's like Christmas presents, knowing where your parents hide the Christmas presents. And you can go there and see what the Christmas presents are, but then you just but then the surprise of what it is gone forever.
Well, what can be done?
Basically, fans are trying to do a campaign to sort of get people to not spoil the episodes and to sort of stay pure, as it will. And, you know, people are going hardcore on Twitter and saying, if you even so much as reveal a single detail on Twitter, I will unfollow you immediately, you know, which is the worst possible thing that could happen on Twitter.
Yes, it is. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, even with shows that I love like Game of Thrones, if I'm going to watch it later, I don't go on Twitter on Sunday night. I don't go on Reddit on Sunday night. I wait until the excitement dies down. But this is worse.
Exactly. You're kind of feel like I'm going to have to be in an underground bunker for the next 6 weeks. It's because – and, you know, I don't really want to read the scripts because what I want to see is see Peter Capaldi say those words as the Doctor. I don't want to actually just see a script just to give me the cue Doctor and read it as text. So it's really, really hard, though, because you want to find out what happened. You want to know, but you can't. You can't. You have to wait.
So what is it about Doctor Who, Graham Burke, that makes you – I mean, you're one of the chief Whovians. There's really no question about it. What is it about this show over so many years since 1963 that has roped so many of you in to this extent?
I think it's just a very exciting, fun show. I think fun is the key thing. It's a show that takes everything seriously and nothing seriously at all. It is a show that kind of combines all the best traditions of British drama, ranging from Monty Python to Prime Suspect to Hammer Horror, and just sort of puts it all into one big blender and purees it. It's wonderful.
Is it possible, Graham Burke, that maybe now with the internet poisoned with these spoilers that, I don't know, Doctor Who fans might get outside for a little while before August 23rd and get off the internet? Perfect excuse.
Stranger things have happened, and I have to say, I am very hesitant to actually check Twitter lately. So perhaps that's going to be the case.
Well, somebody leaked 5 episodes of the new season of Doctor Who onto the internet. Graham Burke is one of the chief Whovians, well, of the universe, and he, like so many others, say stay off Twitter, stay off the internet. Don't give us any spoilers, Graham Burke. Author of Who's 50, the 50 Doctor Who stories to watch before you die, the unofficial companion. Hey, stay off Twitter.
Thanks, Todd. I will.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Well, it's been 2 years since Washington state voters legalized recreational marijuana, and today, for the first time, marijuana stores finally begin selling recreational pot across the state. The first licenses were issued yesterday to the shops by the Washington Liquor Control Board, but this doesn't mean that stores on every corner will be selling marijuana today. In this first wave of licenses that were issued, only about 25 of the more than 300 applications were granted. In Seattle, the state's biggest city with more than 600,000 residents, only one small shop will be up and running. It's a day filled with excitement and dread for the residents of the state. Joining me now is Derek Wong, assignment editor for KUOW in Seattle. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you. Well, of course, Washington's not the first, but it is kind of on the front lines of changing marijuana laws. What does legalization look like in Seattle today, do you think?
Well, legalization here, it looks very happy today. There were people that started to line up as early as yesterday afternoon, And we're also hearing via social media, you know, people are expressing interest from across the country. There, I think I saw a tweet from someone saying they were from Texas. The Canadian press is all over this. They're saying that they're expecting people from British Columbia to cross the border and hit some stores here. So right now, it's a positive day for marijuana aficionados.
Now, Colorado is ahead of you, of course. We all know that. They've had legalized marijuana since January. And we've all seen the stories that Denver and other places in Colorado now have marijuana tourism, where they'll pick you up in a bus and kind of Sherpa you through a marijuana experience if you want. There have been controversy over edibles and also a lot of revenue generated in Colorado, billions from their legalized marijuana. Is Washington likely to go the same way? Is it going to become a tourist mecca, do you think, for pot smokers?
That's an interesting question. I think that could happen. Like Colorado, Washington State has had a medicinal marijuana system in place for several years. And so there's always been this strong history of marijuana culture. There's also, you know, like a hemp day fest every April 20th. So I do see that happening at some point in time. But as you just said, Washington State is kind of behind the curve if you compare us to Colorado. The state hasn't quite gotten their act together when it comes to edibles. So that the plan is to have edibles eventually in retail stores, but that hasn't happened yet. There's also, you know, issues around banking and revenue that the state has estimated, you know, pot sales could generate up to $2 billion over 5 years, but they haven't actually had any sales yet. So it still remains to be seen whether any of this will all pan out.
So what are the lessons that have been taken from sort of the first 6 or 7 months of the Colorado experience? They've had issues with banking. They've had issues with tourism. And certainly lots of money pouring in. What are Washingtonians saying about the Colorado experience?
There's a lot of complaints, actually. I've spoken with several people who are hoping to get retail stores up and running, and they feel that, you know, Colorado, they seem to have their act together, and boom, you know, of course there were shortages there, and there were problems when it first started in Colorado. But, you know, it seems to be smoothing out right now. I mean, I would argue, and state officials would probably argue, that it's kind of an unfair comparison to look at Washington State and Colorado. The one big difference between the two states is that Colorado's medicinal marijuana system was regulated by the state, so that had a built-in pipeline for supply. Whereas in Washington State, we have had this medicinal marijuana system, but it's totally unregulated by the state. A lot of groups, they let the market come up with their own guidelines that they all meet, but it wasn't really regulated by the state. And so when the state took this on, everyone had to start all over. And, you know, they had to do background checks of growers and processors and retail stores and financial statements and all those kinds of things. So it's taken a little bit longer here in Washington.
One of the promises of this new policy, Derek Wong, of course, is all the money. And it makes me wonder what officials in the legislature in either Seattle or in Washington State are promising to do with all that money that they're sure to get when people buy legalized marijuana.
Yeah, it's funny. When this first passed in 2012, the state had to come up with an estimate how much it would raise. And the estimate was kind of humorous. They said it would raise anywhere between $0 and $2 billion over the first 5 years.
Somewhere in there.
So it's supposed to go, it's supposed to be split. About 40% of the tax revenue is supposed to go to the state's general fund and local governments, and the rest is supposed to go to healthcare and drug prevention and education and research. So lawmakers are definitely hoping for some kind of windfall, but, you know, we'll just have to see what happens.
The Denver Post has hired a marijuana critic for their paper, just like a wine critic. Any jobs open there in the Seattle papers?
Not that I've seen. I have heard, if you look at the stores that are opening, there's definitely this effort to cater towards people who may not have been, you know, hardcore marijuana aficionados. There's one store in Tacoma where the owner described the look as being kind of like the Apple store. And there's other stores here that, you know, look like Starbucks colorings and stuff. So there's an effort to kind of mainstream it and maybe, you know, even create a boutique line.
New opportunities even in Seattle. Derek Wong, assignment editor for KUOW in Seattle. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you.
For years, Afghan interpreters, thousands of them, worked on the front lines alongside American soldiers.
We have faced ambushes, IEDs. I have been injured in Nowzat province. One of the team members worked on an IED that I was a little far from him. He died and I got injured. that injured my private part of my body that I cannot have children.
They sometimes watched their friends and neighbors get killed. They risked their lives on a daily basis for pay that was rarely more than $1,000 a month.
Every day, I saw my friends being injured, and I saw their dead body, making friends and see their dead body. That was really ridiculous. I don't want to see any more my friends going to die.
Those are two voices there of Afghan interpreters speaking in a new documentary by Vice Media called The Interpreters. Now, according to new reporting from Vice News, the majority of Afghan interpreters who worked with the United States government are being either denied transit to the United States or are being left in limbo for years on end, unable to get visas to this country. Meanwhile, at home, they are viewed as traitors, particularly by the Taliban, and fear for their lives once NATO and U.S. forces leave.
It means we are done. They're going to catch me. They're going to probably cut my head off, probably, you know.
Ben Anderson is senior producer and reporter with Vice. He's been covering Afghanistan for 7 years and is the filmmaker behind the new documentary called The Interpreters. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
Some disturbing video there and some disturbing images in your film. Part of it is infuriating. Let's say at the top that a lot of these young men, and mostly young men, were allies of the United States. You have American soldiers saying these guys saved our lives in a lot of cases, and they can't get visas. What's behind the delay?
I mean, you know, after spending 8 or 9 months making this film, it's still a mystery. The system is so bad, it seems almost designed not to work. The best answer I've had is that each individual case falls onto someone's desk, and it's just easier for them to say no than it is to say yes. No one wants to be the person who lets that one guy in who might do something wrong in the U.S., despite the fact there's never been any evidence to suggest any of these guys have done anything wrong once they've got to the U.S., because they've already spent years fighting alongside U.S. troops in Afghanistan. You know, they've been vetted.
When you say do something wrong, you mean there's a fear among a bureaucrat that they're going to be responsible for an Afghan coming here and wind up being a terrorist?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
that's the fear.
That's the most logical explanation I've been given. Apart from that, there is no logical explanation. I mean, I met guys in Kabul who have had 40 letters from generals, you know, saying they saved lives. They saved 6, 7, 8 American lives. They've met all the conditions they need to meet, and yet they're still waiting 3, 4, sometimes 5 years to get their visa or just to get no decision at all.
Now, how many of these interpreters have succeeded in coming to the United States?
According to the State Department, it's roughly 3,000. It's probably gone up to closer to 4,000 in the last couple of months. They have sped the process up recently, but as we speak now, there are only a few hundred visas left and between 6,000 and 8,000 interpreters applying for visas. So the vast majority are going to go without unless things change radically very soon.
What is the nature of the threat? Somebody who lives... I have not been to Afghanistan. That's going to be apparent in the question. But somebody who lives in downtown Kabul might not have a lot of concern about Taliban retaliation. But what do many of these guys know about the nature of the threat that's facing them for helping the United States?
They're getting letters. They're getting phone calls. Many have been killed several a week, according to a UN report. So the threat is very real. Even the interpreters who live in Kabul, which is considered to be relatively safe compared to the south and east of the country, they're in hiding. Everybody I interviewed is in hiding. And it's not just the Taliban. Their neighbors, sometimes the Afghan army and Afghan police are saying, you worked with the Americans, you're in trouble once they leave. Who's going to look after you then? You know, the guys we funded and trained are also threatening them.
Is there a better case, you know, for somebody who wants to emigrate to the United States than having, you mentioned it, you have shots of guys with 20 and 30 letters directly from a U.S. general or some respected U.S. official vouching for the person's loyalty and their service to the United States. At the same time, they have enemies at home who are threatening their lives. My cursory understanding of refugee law is that makes them a pretty good candidate.
Everyone in the film has met every condition necessary 10 times over. I mean, they need, you know, several letters. They've got 40 letters. It's a heartbreaking sight to see them carrying around these little files with these laminated letters that their lives literally depend on. And yet they're waiting months, years, just to get a decision. Not necessarily a yes, but maybe a re-interview, or they'll be told their case has been denied. And some of the stories we heard, there was Srosh, who you heard at the beginning there. I mean, I was in Sangin with him for 5 weeks with the US Marines, and you literally had to watch every step you took because there were IEDs everywhere. Every day people were getting blown up and were losing legs or were getting killed. He took a month or so off for stress treatment. So on his record, it says that he left. Doesn't say why, no context whatsoever, but that's a black mark against his name, which usually means a failure. Now, there are some brilliant lawyers in New York called IRAP, the Iraq Refugee Assistance Program, who are trying to get that overturned, but just a tiny little black mark like that against your name, he left at one point for some reason, can mean you're denied a visa.
Now, you mentioned the Marine unit that Srosh was with and that you were with in your embed there. What do U.S. personnel, U.S. soldiers who fought in combat in Afghanistan say about these Terps that they worked with?
I haven't met a single one who hasn't got anything but the highest praise for these guys and considers them to be American veterans and part of their unit, which they're leaving behind. So, you know, I think most people now are aware of the massive PTSD issues, you know, amongst returning veterans. A huge contributing factor to that is they feel like they're leaving one of their best buddies behind and someone who helped them out so much because, you know, the counterinsurgency policy in Afghanistan was about trying to win hearts and minds. It's impossible to even attempt that without the interpreters who are there side by side with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no matter what.
Now, you mentioned that some 3,000 interpreters have managed to get visas, so there is some success in this program, surely. You also covered an American soldier, a captain, I believe, an officer, who's taken it upon himself to help as many of these guys as possible become success stories. What's the situation there?
His story is incredible. He was...
What's his name?
Matt Zeller. He features in the film, and his interpreter saved his life, literally killed two Taliban who were sneaking up to capture or kill him. The interpreter didn't want a visa. He didn't want to leave his country. He loved his country. 2 or 3 years later, another captain who had replaced Matt Zeller said, listen, your guy, Janice, his name is facing serious dangers. We need to get him out of here. Matt spoke to congressmen. He got a massive publicity campaign going. It still took him 3 years. And, you know, this guy literally saved several American lives and was getting regular death threats by the Taliban. You know, there couldn't be a more conclusive case of someone meeting the necessary conditions, and it still took 3 years.
You know, after Vietnam, Ben Anderson, we repatriated or allowed into this country thousands of Vietnamese refugees, many of whom helped the United States or were affiliated with the CIA because there was concern that they would face repercussions at home.
You know, I think America and you know, Britain, where I'm from as well, will find themselves in a foreign country again in the not too distant future, I'm sure, wanting the help of locals. The message from this is don't give them that help because once they've finished, you know, using you, they'll abandon you.
There are thousands of translators and interpreters in Afghanistan who have helped United States forces and United States personnel in their efforts there over the last 10 to 12 years, and thousands of them cannot find a way into the United States under our current visa programs. Ben Anderson is senior producer and reporter with Vice. He's written an ebook about Afghan interpreters. You can download it at vicenews.com, and you can also go there to watch the documentary, The Interpreters. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Well, before we go, we want to take a moment to congratulate our co-producer, WNYC Radio, on its 90th anniversary. That's 9 decades of news and talk and cultural programming, making this station a touchstone for information and culture here in New York City over the decades. We'll be marking the milestone with a remembrance of a speech given by Langston Hughes, heard on WNYC in 1957.
Negro writers, just by being black, have always been on the blacklist. Do you know that there are libraries in our country that will not stock a book by a Negro writer, not even as a gift? And so censorship for us begins with the color line.
That's later this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.